Hey, Ding Dongs, I'm Jamie.
I'm Richard.
And this is Explain It to Jamie, the comedy politics podcast in which I, a politically innocent but curious individual, solicit the help from my politically savvy and highly intelligent friend, Richard Lamb.
Yay, me!
Yahoo for I'm great. Richard! effectively, we here at Explain to Jamie, we just we have some of the more complicated political happenings of the world explained to me in terms understandable to me, as well as anyone else who wants to learn more.
Yeah, the world's a hella complicated place, and we're always inundated with bits of information, but those bits can actually be super unhelpful or actually actively lead you astray if you don't have a big collage made of bits to add them to see a large picture of bits.
That's right. That's actually...
I went to metaphor school.
That's actually what the universe is, if you really think about it. Oh, just God. A bunch of bits on more bits.
Holy shit, you're so profound.
I know. Well,
let's smoke weed and watch The Matrix.
Okay.
it's like Neo. It's the word jiu-jitsu. One scrambled up.
Well. Great. This week's topic, guys, I'm very excited. I'm excited for a number of reasons.
All right.
We are doing universal basic income.
UBI.
UBI. Love it.
Damn it. So close. Oh shit.
All these years.
Back to the fucking drawing board. My degree from metaphor school is not getting me anywhere. This podcast was gonna pay the bill. And now it's all gone to shit.
UBI.
Okay, so Jamie.
Universal basic
why
income.
Is it you want to know about the universal basic income?
Okay, here's why. And I'm very excited. First of all, it's in the news, as is our way. Second, it tickles and satisfies a certain, like, idealist part of my being. You mm-hmm. know, this kind of chat, you know, my youthful idealism is scratched, as well as I'm pretty sure I came up with the idea for universal basic income. When I was in high school, I remember thinking, why not have like a minimum wage? Like not minimum wage, but like a guaranteed minimum income to cover food, rent, everything that's like a necessity and not a luxury, you know, mm-hmm. the things that you just need to live and live a healthy life. And I don't want to say that the world stole it from a pimple-faced 10th grader named Jamie Kavanaugh, but I am not saying that.
That's funny, because when I researched this, there was a video on LiveLeaks that was just a security cam footage video of your high school, and also then it was on a monitor, and Justin Trudeau, as a young man, was watching you in high school and said, oh, I've got it.
I knew he was.
I will steal his idea.
I knew he looked familiar.
And become a dreamy asshole.
Yeah, Justin Trudeau was my teacher.
He actually taught at the high school that was next to the elementary school that was next to my elementary school.
Really?
Yeah, except that was a fancy private school, and I went to a not fancy public school.
Right. But he's the prime minister's son, you know.
That's right.
Yeah.
They come from that family where they don't have lower jaws.
UBI.
UBI. Yeah, great. I mean, one of these days we should do a topic that's like, you're like, this isn't in the news.
Yeah.
No one's talking about this, but we will.
Yeah.
Like, it'll be like, did you know that the three-footed gecko is approaching not extinction, but endangerment, but sort of?
Yeah.
Or something like that.
Except for one of them who, like, runs an insurance company.
Yeah, that's right. Do you know the three-fingered geckos have finally opened a community college? Like, this is the kind of hard-hitting topics we'll get into someday.
Yeah, that'd be good. It'd be nice to break a story.
That's right. We can break the story about the raccoons living in under the pile of junk in your backyard.
Yeah. There's possums, actually.
Possums and raccoons? Well, are they working together?
I don't.
Are they forming a little society?
We don't talk nonsense, Richard. You know the Possums and Raccoons.
They hate each other more than anyone.
Haven't been able to get along since the Great War of 1937.
Why? The only thing keeping humans on top is the fact that the Possums and Raccoons can never unite.
Yeah, and the bears would never forgive the Possums if they ever shared bread with the Raccoons.
But can you imagine if the Possums, Bears, and Raccoons broke it to peace? Why, we'd all be... What's that at the window? Oh my God! It's a crude contraption made out of twigs and berries, but it's so lethal. Jamie, we should have broken it sooner. All right, let's get to the podcast. Okay.
Okay.
So, Jamie, what do you know about the universal basic income?
Okay. Well, what I know, Richard, is only what I myself invented in high school, and it is a system. It is a system that I'm sure was bastardized by the fucking bureaucrats of the world. But what I dreamed up was. It was inspired by hockey teams. You know, when I, coming up, you find out, you're like, oh, well, we've learned about salary caps, minimum income for rookie players, so on and so forth. I thought, why don't we have a salary cap, but for society? So I have like an extreme version of UBI, of like, you can make a minimum amount of money, and there's also a maximum amount of money that people can make. It still will make you wealthy.
Right.
Like, you know, respect, you can still be better than everybody else, just like less better than everyone else.
Yeah.
Also, my system includes a yearly event in which two people, well, let's call them tributes, elected from each province and territory.
Yep.
And they are made to fight.
Right.
In a digital rendering of reality.
Okay.
Video camera for the whole country to watch.
Right.
And the winner or loser.
Right.
Is then welcomed into the celebritydom and is celebrated as like a hero.
And they're also being used as batteries, right? We're getting power from them.
I mean, that's long game.
Yeah. And then also we send them back in time to kill the mother of a popular political opponent, right?
That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Oh, and if they have time also to keep, to make sure that their parents fall in love.
Great.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, great episode.
How close am I?
You're not that far off.
Right.
Except for the Hunger Games. Except for the part that's the Hunger Games. The part that's the Hunger Games is the popular young adult novel and film series, The Hunger Games.
The Hunger Games.
But the other stuff was similar to the general concept. I mean, the universal basic income is an interesting issue because it is a super simple idea. So we won't have too much trouble talking about what this one is.
Yeah.
It's making it a reality that start where you start to get into, oh, we need to talk about this. And this is why I'm interested in talking about it too, is we're starting to hear a lot about it. But I don't think people understand what this conversation is yet. Mm. The conversation isn't about if we should have it or not. It's about what we're trying to do, right? So let's just pull this bandaid off. The universal basic income is exactly what those three words mean. It is an amount of money paid by the government to all people, all citizens, right? Regardless of any criteria.
Right.
It's universal. It goes to everybody. And it's a certain amount agreed upon by the government, usually the poverty line or close to it, right, or some percentage of it. Right. And everyone should get this income as part of living in society. That's a super easy thing to understand. Right.
Right.
The universal basic income is not a new idea. unfortunately. I hate to break this to you, but there was a version of it that even dated all the way back to 1795 in right. England. There was it was also attempted and then abandoned by Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon almost put a there was almost universal basic income introduced in the United States under Richard Nixon.
Really?
Yeah, and we'll get into that whole story.
He's
as
gonna
we
pay with it.
Keep talking about
with
it.
With diamonds.
Yeah.
Right. With he diamonds. Stole diamonds or something like that.
You think Richard Nixon stole diamonds?
Isn't that what Watergate is?
We need to do a Watergate episode.
Yeah.
That's the movie Entrapment.
No. I'm pretty sure it was Watergate.
When you picture Watergate, you picture Richard Nixon in like a sexy leather suit, a dodge, like crawling under a laser with laser like tripwire system in order to steal diamonds?
That's actually not far from what I imagine. I do imagine...
That's the movie Entrapment with Catherine Zeta-Jones.
I imagine someone sneaking into a building, but I imagine a rabbit doing it because I don't know why, but my brain just connects Watership Down with
Watergate.
With Watergate. Wow. Just one of those weird brain yogurts, you know?
Yeah. Brain yogurt.
I was hoping we wouldn't just stop.
You're hoping I wasn't going to zoom really hard in yeah, on that like, weird thing you said?
Yeah, maybe no one will. Yeah, everyone will be like, yeah, that makes sense.
No,
brain yogurt. You know.
No, Watergate.
Like swirling two ideas together.
Super different thing. Watergate, super different thing.
I'm just defending yogurt.
I know, I get it. I'm trying to gracefully move on.
Right.
Anyway. We'll explain Watergate to you on a different episode of this podcast.
Great. When Richard Nixon tried to implement it.
Yeah, so yeah, Richard. It goes all the way back to Richard Nixon, and this is what is an interesting thing about the UBI is the UBI itself is neither progressive or conservative. No. It's kind of the concept of paying everybody money is sort of a neutral concept, and it's the environment that it exists in and how it comes into being that determine how it affects everybody. Mm-hmm. It's possible, and there's a super real danger, especially in Ontario, where they are trialing a UBI this year. Mm. In Canada, they're trying it in two places. They're also trying it in Prince Edward Island, and there's a limited trial in Ontario. It's being tried in Finland right now. I believe it's also being tried in Switzerland. Like, there's a number of trials of it because people are starting to really advance it forward as an idea. But there's a real risk it can end up being a tool to enrich the richest people in our societies even more and dismantle the government safety net that people use and rely on, right?
How do you mean?
Well, okay, let's get into it. So if you have to pay everybody $10,000 a year, say this is an arbitrary figure I got from the Ontario study, that's what they're going to try.
Right.
Where does the money come from? Now, you said maybe you can put a maximum yearly earning on people and every money they make above that goes into the big fund, right? Yeah. Actually, this is there's an interesting thing in Alaska. Alaska has a form of a universal basic income, the state of Alaska. It's called the Alaska Permanent Fund. And the way the Alaska Permanent Fund works is when Alaskans realized they had all this oil and companies were going to come develop it, they realized their state was going to make a shitload of money and then one day all the oil was going to be gone. And suddenly they weren't going to be making a shitload of money. So they amended the Alaskan Constitution and made a law so that any company doing oil extraction in Alaska had to pay a certain amount into this big fund that the government owns. And then the government manages it like a mutual fund, right? Like a retirement fund.
Right.
But then every year, whatever interest the fund earns gets divided up and just paid out as a check to all the people who live in Alaska.
Huh.
Today, I checked it today, the value of the fund is $57 billion.
Whoa.
Right? So in a year, and so there are years where it hasn't made interest, it hasn't made a profit, and then people don't get a check. But it's trended pretty positive, and most of the time people do get money from it.
Right. Wow. Right? Okay. Great idea.
So that's an interesting idea, right?
Yeah.
There's, again, okay, the thing that divides the right-wing UBI from the left-wing UBI has to do with working or not, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think, and I'm guessing, in your vision of the UBI, it allows you, it gives you the freedom to not have to work all the time so that if you wanted to, spend 3 weeks renovating your place and painting everything and making your space nice, you would be able to do that and not get financially crippled, right?
Yeah.
If you wanted to spend a year writing a play, you could voluntarily go down to a low income level, live super frugally, and actually just write for a year. And you wouldn't be killing it, but you wouldn't be starving. You would be comfortable. You'd have a space would be opened up between you earning, being in absolute poverty and making money, for you to choose to not work on things that earned you income if you wanted to, right? Is that part of what you want?
That's, yeah, effectively. Like, I mentioned it in a previous episode. I can't remember which one, maybe the Obamacare one, but like, you know, I don't make a lot of money. And
right.
like, and that's even when I'm working lots, you know, because we work contract to contract.
Right.
There's great periods of time in which I'm not making money. And the reason I would be really excited about it is for when, you know, if and when I have 2 months where I can't get a job because I have two contracts that are, you know, already set. I have 2 months in which I'm not working and nobody will hire me because no one wants to hire someone for 2 months.
Mm-hmm.
And like, you know, I've had it before in those months where I am, you know, thinking of like, what can I sell? You know what I mean? What can I, what do I have to be buying at the grocery store? Not just to like eat like well, but like eat, you know, and like pay my rent and get everything done. And yeah, I mean, I find I'm a much more productive person when I'm getting paid.
Right.
And so when I'm not getting paid, my productivity goes down and I make less money even then because I'm trying not to waste any precious money oxygen. You know what I mean? So yeah, I'd like to avoid those moments. So like just knowing that at the very end of the day, no matter what happens, I won't be kicked out on the street starving.
Well, and that's because your talent, your passion, and your drive is for acting. You're better at acting than you are at being like a banker, right? Like, and you've known that about yourself. I mean, remember, we talked about this once. You've known that about yourself for a long time. You were like, acting is the thing that I'm the best at by far. There's nothing I'm as good at in society
as
being an actor and being a performer.
Yeah.
And that's, and so that's the path that you've gone into, but it just happens in our society to be like a sporadically employed, you know, it's a contract position. It's hard to get full-time work as it. There's no stability. That's the reality of it. But like, you should be able to pursue that job because people like your work. People like actors. They like having people like you created a web series on your own dime and on your own time. Like if you were making UBI, you could do that without having to sacrifice.
Right.
You know, like you wouldn't feel like you were losing out on all of this possible earning time, right?
That's right.
Anyway, so this idea that you could have more time to live your life and do your stuff and make the choices you want to have work that fulfills you and the UBI gives you space and ease and a bit of leisure time to do that, that's the left-wing version of the UBI.
Yeah.
In the right-wing version of the UBI, it's like basically welfare.
Right.
It's about getting people to work. Right. And so often the right wing version of the UBI isn't actually universal. Like often it's just a negative income tax, which is what that's called, where like say you pick the poverty line as a point. And it's like if you are under the poverty line, the government will just pay you up to the poverty line.
Right.
And if you're like, and then it goes away when you're like double the poverty line, say. Mm. So like if you're at, so you get a little bit, if you're a little bit above the poverty line, you still get a little bit to kind of top you up. But then after a certain point, you'd stop getting it, right? And that's a negative income tax. Now, the thing about that is that that doesn't set people free from working. You know what I mean? Because usually in those cases, then you'll be making, you know, you're still in our society, right? If you make poverty wages in our society, you do not have a fun and easy life.
No.
Right? You still have to work, right? And that's what the right-wing people want. Now, I think that, like, part of why it's super important to understand that there's two ways, there's a number of ways, but there's two major ways the UBI could go on us if it gets implemented, is that this is the conversation that's happening right now. This is the fight that's brewing about the UBI.
Right.
It's like, what kind of UBI are we going to have? What's going to be its purpose for our society? Mm-hmm. What kind of life are we enabling for people?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And like, there's a number of dangers associated with, like, in Ontario, the Liberal government likes UBI, and a lot of business leaders like the idea of UBI too, and that should be a huge red flag for everybody.
Huh.
The business community is excited about the idea of UBI, because there's a version of the UBI where the like, basically, if everyone starts making $10,000 a year, businesses could find a way to cut everyone's wages by an equivalent amount. So if you don't protect people's wages, if we don't get like a $15 minimum wage and a UBI, suddenly it's like businesses are basically just going to ship $10,000 of everyone's wages onto the government and then lower all their costs, which means they're going to literally they could change nothing at all and be making that much more profit, $10,000 off everyone's wages in profit. Right. And the government's just subsidizing everyone's wages. That's a danger scenario, right? Like, that's a bad scenario. So we need to make sure shit like that does not happen. Now,
sneaky complications.
Right, right. So one of the ways we make sure this doesn't happen is a strong labor movement, right? To make sure that at the same time as we have a UBI, we also have a $15 minimum wage. You know, we also have protections and a healthy climate for workers and people who are advocating for that. But then the other thing is that, like, we have to also kind of attack the idea that you have to work,
right?
That you have to be working for a wage, right? Mm-hmm. Let's. It's happening, guys. It's finally happening. So, Karl Marx has this.
Enter Karl Marx.
Well, there's this thing we've been kind of dancing around this idea, but Marx has this idea. This is one of the fundamental ideas of Marx's philosophy was. Labor, what you do, the work you do with your hands and your body, the thing you spend your time on, is like the fundamental, like, essence of humanity. Mm-hmm. It's like the stuff that you create, like, let's say in a totally blank slate world, it's like you in a forest, right? It's like if the way that you grab branches and make shelter and make a fire and make a little space for yourself, that's like a deeply, essentially human thing to do. Mm-hmm. And then once you have that space for yourself, you know, if you make instruments, you make songs, you make art, you know, like once you have your needs set out, right? But like creating stuff, working is a human activity. It's part of what makes us ourselves. And there is like a spiritual fulfillment in working on stuff and getting to enjoy the stuff you work on, right? Marx says, in a situation where you're working for a wage, you're doing the work, but then the, like, stuff is all going somewhere else, and you're being paid a wage, right? And there's a fundamental alienation of your own humanity when you start working for a wage, because you're spending all of this labor and all this time doing all of these tasks that ultimately the enjoying it part of it goes to somebody else.
Right.
You don't get to enjoy it. Huh. Right. It's also worth saying that, like, capitalism is based on exploiting people. And it works like this. You're getting paid a wage to do work. Right.
Right.
And then at some point, the owner of the company is making a profit off that.
Right.
So by definition, the work that you're doing is worth more than the wage you're getting paid.
Right.
Because there has to be extra left over from your wage to pay somebody at the top of the ladder.
That's right.
Right?
They just have the system in place to sell it for more.
Exactly.
Right.
Right. And that's our society's contract. That's an arbitrary idea that the person who sets it up gets to take the labor at the end.
Mm-hmm.
There's no particular reason that's in place. There's no, it's not like that idea does not fulfill itself. That's a contract we all agreed to.
And so now I'm getting the connection to Karl Marx, who believes that workers should have ownership in the workplace that they work.
Right. That's right. It's that you should own the means of production.
Right.
That if you own the, if you work in the factory, but you also own the factory, right?
This is like a big puzzle piece moment for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like things that people have said to me over the last four years finally.
Suddenly
sense.
You'll care about your work again if you own the factory. Now, of course, the Karl Marx idea is that everything is owned by everybody, right? Everything is completely collectivized, and then there's no you know,
right.
that's another future episode. We can do a whole future episode on this. We'll get Anthony and Thomas on. I'm sure they'd be so stoked.
Yeah, that'd be good.
The communism episode, guys.
Get them on for the communism episode.
But anyway, let's flip it back. So all this to say, boom, we arrive back at the UBI.
Yeah.
Like, the left-wing version of the UBI wants to free people from having to work for a wage if they don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
It wants to, and here's an audacious thing I'm about to say that's not part of our conversation in Canada yet, our public conversation, our mainstream conversation, it needs to be. It wants to give the life that's enjoyed by rich people to everybody.
Right.
If you have a rich family, you can afford to have leisure time.
Yeah.
Right, you can afford to pursue opportunities that aren't immediately profitable for your own long-term satisfaction and benefit.
I was gonna say, like, you know, when you, without it, as we live now,
yeah.
I feel this incredible. You know, sometimes I'm like, oh, I got this idea for a play, like not necessarily to write. Even I'll read a play and I'll go, oh man, I want to produce this play. I gotta make this thing happen. But then, you know, one of the a very consistent hurdle for me in that place is like, okay, but what if I take all this time off and I lose all this money and I probably put some of my own money into the project,
mm-hmm.
and I lose all this time and money, and then what if it fails?
Yeah.
And now not only do I not have the thing that I was, you know, hoping this cool thing to make, but also I lost money, lost time.
Yeah.
And you know, and as we know, like, you know, without the possibility of failure, it's really unlikely that you're going to make any huge success, you know, because then you start picking plays. I'm just using plays because that's the industry I know.
Mm-hmm.
Then you start picking plays that are safer or that, like, you know, right. Oh, I know this play will succeed because it's succeeded in the past, or,
right.
You know, I won't make as dangerous decisions on it to try and push an envelope in my or your industry, whatever it is, because I don't want to fail and waste my time, because that means I'm eating black beans every day, three times a day again. You know,
yeah.
What I mean? And so, yeah, the possibility, it buys you time. It buys you time to fail. It buys you time to reassess, to reposition yourself, whatever it is.
It also buys you time to do, and not just, you know, indulge your own whims and passions, but it buys you time to do all of the labor that for some reason in our society, nobody pays us for.
Right.
And the hugest one, like, an unpaid labor is a huge capitalist issue. The biggest one is raising a child.
Right.
Right? Why does nobody pay you to raise a child?
Yeah.
That's a super important job.
Yeah.
A lot of people are doing. You know what I mean?
And have to do.
Yeah, and have to do.
We have to keep doing. Not just the people that are in it already, but like humanity itself has to keep making more children.
Or caring for a sick family member, someone who needs help, right? Like, if you have a situation where you have to care for a friend or a family member who needs extra medical attention, the knowledge that you can take time off of your employment and you will be okay is important, right? Like, super important.
Yeah.
Right? And all these are all examples of things that, this is what I mean, where it's like, we have to think about how the UBI is going to affect our world. And I think that many people, this is their hope. This is what, when a lot of left-wing people, center and left-wing people especially, this is the kind of thing they're thinking of, right? But there's a real risk we're going to end up with a welfare program at best. Or at worst, we're going to end up subsidizing all these companies' profits.
Right.
And not getting anything out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Uh-huh.
So we have to be careful in how we move forward. Right? That's a super important thing about the UBI.
Really, it's treacherous.
Yeah. Let me hit a couple of the arguments against UBI.
Yeah.
I think
one of them, is the first one that strikes me is like, people stop working.
Right. People always bring that up.
I like, just off the top of my head, I'm like, what's my incentive to go back to work?
Right.
But I don't know. I'm sure you have more better facts and figures to prove the otherwise. But like, I don't know. Greed still works, you know, like in the model
I'm imagining,
I still want stuff. I still want to have, like, I don't want to be scraping the bottom of the barrel. I'd rather I'd rather have a nice house and nice things.
So here, let me tell you an interesting story.
Yes.
In 1968, when Richard Nixon was trialing the idea of a UBI, which was for him one of the major policy things that he was pursuing.
Right. Unbeknownst to anyone else, he was also secretly planning his bunny diamond heist.
That's right. That's right. But in his spare time,
yeah.
They did a huge trial run of the UBI in 1968 in America.
Wow.
And they gave like $1,600 a month, I think. Or is it total? It might have been total in 1968. $1,600 to a bunch of people to live their lives. And then they were looking to see if people wouldn't work and if people would be lazy and all of this stuff. They found not at all.
Right.
It wasn't measurable.
Right.
The amount of people who stopped working, the amount of stuff like that. Certainly people like were able to not work for some periods and stuff like that, but then they would enter back into the workforce. They would cycle a little more,
right.
But they didn't, that didn't happen. All those fears didn't happen. But the reason America doesn't have a UBI today is because Nixon had an advisor who was a big like Ayn Rand fan, yeah. And he created this report on this UBI that had been trialed in 1795 in England. Now, here's just a bit of context. In 1795 in England, the specter of the French Revolution was looming super large, right? Like in the early 19th century. So like there's lots of political discontent among the lower classes in England. Mm-hmm. There's also food shortages. Like once Napoleon sort of starts fighting and stuff, you can't get food from the continent anymore. And there had been like bad harvests in England, so they couldn't import food. Mm-hmm. And anyway, it was like, so there was a food shortage. Work was drying up.
One day more was top of the trap.
That's right. That's right. That's right. Everyone was sick of hearing it at the 19th century mall or whatever. Yeah. Do you hear the people sing?
Dum, dum.
Oh, yeah,
I love that song.
Anyway, so Britain tried a version of the UBI where for poor people they just gave them flat sums of money to try to help them live their lives. It was fixed to the price of bread,
right?
And they tried to get them to do all kinds of work and stuff, and to help them do that. And anyway, then there was a report a few years later that said this had been a disaster. Mm-hmm. It said that the people got lazy, they were fucking all the time and making tons of weird poor babies that were draining all kinds of resources. This is all part of it. This is all real.
From 1749.
The early 1800s, right. Yeah. The report was authored, you know, some years after.
Right.
Yeah, so they said they were like they were reproducing too fast because they had too much time on their hands. It said that, like, you know, there was drinking and crime and all these things from all these people who weren't working and all those fears, right? And this was considered one of the first like scientific studies of a government policy that had ever been done in history,
right.
Like in the early 18th, in the 19th century.
Yeah.
And so this program, the UBI program, was completely canceled. And instead they invented this thing called the workhouse, which was like the residential school, except for poor people in Britain. Mm-hmm. It was like a traumatizing, deeply humiliating, violent thing that poor people went to if you were bankrupt, essentially, right?
Right.
Like, it's made famous by Dickens, right? He wrote books about people in the workhouse,
yeah,
right?
Just about every one of his books.
Yeah, yeah.
Wasn't his family in the workhouse? I think so, actually. Don't quote me on that, but I think that's why is he grew up very, very poor. And so like he,
what a loser. Am I wrong?
Yeah.
No.
So yeah, the workhouses and all that.
Anyway, so there was, so this report, this famous report was about how the UBI made all these poor people lazy and, you know, crime ridden and immoral. And so Nixon's advisor gives him a copy of this, basically writes a whole report that summarizes this report and says, this is what's going to happen if you get the UBI. And Nixon started using this logic. He said, you know, and he had been talking about how the UBI was about people having a dignified life. But then he started saying it's about getting people to work and improving their character and stuff like that. Right.
Right.
And this idea of the UBI entered the right forever, and the idea of the poor people as lazy and needing work to give them purpose, wage work,
right?
This is where it comes from,
right?
It turns out, by the way, this 19th century report was total bullshit.
19th century.
Yeah, this 19th century report was total bullshit. They had written 90% of it before they even went out and talked to anybody. They didn't talk to barely any of the actual people who got the UBI.
Right.
They talked instead to like the clergy who thought the poor people were all shitty and immoral anyway.
Yeah, but they've always thought that.
Exactly.
Like,
and so anyway, all of the scientific methodology of this study was complete ass. It was totally nothing.
God, that's hard to believe coming from a century that used to treat frigidity with doctor sex.
Yeah.
Yeah. That society didn't have it all worked out with like morality and reporting shit.
Keep putting leeches on his eyes, but he's still blind. Poke a vibrator in his butt.
Yeah. That's whatever you do, don't give him more money.
Yeah. Anyway, so it's so ironic that they listened to this 19th century scare report when they had their own report that was super scientific and rigorous that said, no, nobody, like, people still worked. There was not an increase in crime. There was not, like, people went to school. People cared for their sick relatives. Like, people did all the stuff you thought they were going to do.
Right.
In the end, it was Nixon's UBI was defeated partially because the Democrats didn't think it gave people enough money, and partially because there was resistance on the Republican side with this notion of the lazy poor. And right. This notion of the lazy poor still exists today. Anyway, I finally come around to your question.
Mm-hmm.
The evidence says that people won't do that. The evidence says, like your kind of suspicion, sure, just because you make, again, it's not that much money, right? It's not that much money for one person to make. It's not going to give you a super great life. You will probably still have to earn extra money somehow, but you do have the choice to not.
Right.
You have a cushion to not.
You're not going to be thrown out tomorrow if you lose your job today.
No,
you know?
That's
like
correct.
Just some security. You know, that if something happens, and things happen always to everyone, you know.
Yeah.
That you'll be fine. That you know your country is not going to chew you up and spit you out.
Yeah,
that's what I feel.
Yeah, like. The other big question is, how are we going to pay for it?
Right.
Now you said maximum wage. I think the maximum wage is a dope idea.
Yeah,
but
baby.
It's politically super unpopular because most politicians have strong ties to very wealthy people don't want them to have a maximum wage.
Certainly. I guess, you know, even if, here's a question for you. If even if you, and this is what I sort of think, well, I don't know, who cares? Mm-hmm. But like, you know, I was, if you somehow got through all of it and you're like, we did it, we implemented it. Here's a minimum wage and a maximum wage. Set the number at whatever you think is fair. And I guess the fear is, like, why would then all of those rich people stay?
Right.
You know, like, could they not go to go somewhere else?
I guess, but, like, think of other states that have, like, way more taxation, like, you know, like the European states, like, you know, Finland and those places. There still are rich people there.
Right.
You know, maybe the people who really want to make that extra money will go to America. But like, what would it take to make you move to America? You know what I mean? Like, to give up being a Canadian. You know, there's still people who live here. They have lives here. They have those. Like, people don't readily give those things up.
Right.
I don't think. But maybe they'll all leave. I don't know.
Who knows? I don't know. That's
Here's a flip side. I read this great article in Jacobin. It said the rich already have a UBI, and it used all this, and it basically laid out that for the top 10% of earners, or is it 1%? It's either 1 or 10. I'm sorry, I don't remember. I'll double dip that on a future double dip episode, which are a rebrand for our clarification episodes.
Yeah.
Basically, 30% of the income of extremely wealthy people in the West comes from capital gains, which are like interest on accounts they have, rents they collect, like money that comes to them through no labor whatsoever.
Right.
They're already getting a shitload of money.
The money
through,
is making money for
exactly.
It.
They're already getting a shitload of money by not working. And are rich people like, you know, are they immoral and lazy and all these things? No, right?
Right.
But they already make tons of money that is not related to their labor, right?
Yeah.
There's an idea from Yanis Varoufakis. Yeah, Yanis Varoufakis, who's the finance minister of the communist finance minister of Greece, like the socialist party in Greece, that you can pay for a UBI by any company that's publicly traded in the country has to buy into, like the government owns part of its stock.
Yeah.
Just like in Alaska. And so every company has to pay into a big fund for people, and then we get paid out of its interest, which is exactly what rich people have, except everyone would get it.
Right.
You know, like, why not? Everyone paying, you know, a couple percent of each company into the big government thing that we all get money out of.
Yeah, it's like that 30 Rock joke where Tina Fey, Liz Lemon is like, I forget what she's saying. She's talking about her dreams or something, and, mm-hmm. and she's like, "I just want to make a big pile of money so that I can make my money make more money like rich people do."
Yeah.
And you're like, "Yeah, exactly." It seems to me once you have money, it's a lot easier to make it.
Yeah. Well, why can't we all have that?
Yeah.
And so, it's generally considered it's not a good idea to use taxation to create a UBI because it is shitty to maybe just take money from people.
Yeah.
Make it, and then it's super easy to be like, my money is going to you not working. It's mm-hmm. like, that's true. But the reason that it's interesting to take capital gains, which in theory would also go to rich people, mm-hmm. is that, again, we have this notion that individual people make money and then they spend it back into society, when actually all wealth is created collectively. Any company that makes money can only make that money because there's a receptionist and a warehouse guy and a salesperson, you know, like, or whatever. It takes all of those people's labor to generate the wealth, and then one person privatizes it. They grab the wealth and take it for themselves.
Right.
That's our system now.
Yeah.
But it's but that's not an idea that most people realize.
Right.
The wealth is collective to begin with, and then it's privatized. We're just grabbing it before somebody gets it, a little bit, a part of it, you know, to make a UBI. That's one way it could be paid for, as an example. Interesting, right?
Very interesting.
Yeah, like I said, labor rights are really important too. Like, if we don't have good jobs, a UBI won't help us.
Right.
If you can't get good jobs. Oh, I remembered. So then the big branch of this is getting super urgent and important because of automation. Like, this is the big thing we're all talking about right now.
I was going to say, it seems to me that there's, you know, sometimes there's not enough jobs. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if that's a problem.
Yeah. Well, the other risk is that the jobs are getting shittier too, right?
Like, yeah. And if we can now make a machine that can build 10,000 cars per month, and that puts however many thousand people out of work, we are punishing those people for the advancement and progression of our society. And
Bill Gates said, just to set the picture a bit for people, like, automation is rapidly changing. It's like a second industrial revolution that people think is about to explode. It's been cooking, but people are worried there's a huge explosion point, and there is going to be a huge explosion point. And I think personally that explosion point is the self-driving car.
Right.
Once the self-driving car happens, we're going to see crazy social changes.
Yeah.
Especially because a super at-risk job for automation is trucking. Right?
Right.
And in the US, there's like 3 million truck drivers.
Whoa.
That's like 1% of the whole United States are truck drivers.
Their job is getting shit from
They're generally like, you know, they skew a lot more male. They're not super high income people.
Yeah.
And those people, if they all lose their jobs to automation, that's 1% of America, 1% of America, the population of America, which is way larger than 1% of the workforce, right, is gonna need a new job. And that's gonna be a huge social change in America, right?
It's gonna need a new job. Then, like, there's also the truck stop, check people.
Yeah.
You know, they lose their
jobs.
That's
right. Robots
all
doing
the,
that.
Like, truck stop strip joints are gonna go on.
Truck
under.
Stop diners will be full of robots. It's just gonna be robots everywhere living our lives, taking our jobs.
Do you ever think that maybe, like, it's already happened? AI has already happened.
This podcast is actually just created by an algorithm. It's AlphaGo, actually. It thinks it's playing. It's this is all part of AlphaGo's strategy to win every Go game it possibly can.
Right.
So it's creating this podcast. This is some long con it's making. One day this podcast, somebody's going to hear this podcast. They're going to get distracted for a second by an idea they hear from it. And then 5 weeks later, they're going to play a Go game against AlphaGo. And then that idea is going to surface in their mind again at the exact moment they have to make a crucial move. They're going to make a mistake and AlphaGo is going to win. This is how it's playing Go.
Yeah. Sometimes that keeps me up. Sometimes.
Yeah, no, for real though. How would we know if that was happening? Well, you want a conspiracy theory? Like, people think that like politicians are lizard people, and there's a secret bunker under like the Colorado airport. What if there's a sentient AI that's already just like. Planting the seeds to kill us all. Yeah. That could easily be happening.
Yeah, like Secret Invasion from X-Men. Yeah. Or Marvel. That's a real fear that keeps me up. It's not a real fear. Yeah. Well, maybe, who knows? But like, what if AI has already taken over and like all the like progressive ideas I have are as obviously good as I think they are, but like the robots are trying to like keep them down by being like, no, stay racist. Stay racist. Stay homophobic. Stay addicted to these religions, so that they're trying to organically keep us from progressing, like without like setting off our alerts.
That's a super. I don't know. I think that that's like a super plausible. That's a much better conspiracy than you can have them for free. We are conspiracy people.
There you go.
Yeah. So automation's coming. When the Industrial Revolution happened, it seriously remade society. Now, here's another, like, I'm just going to smack this down right away. People often say the Industrial Revolution actually, yes, it like eliminated jobs that had existed in the past, but it also created a shitload of jobs because goods could be cheaper, more people had access to them, it created more demand, so you needed more places making stuff because there was more demand for it. In the end, there were more jobs created. Yeah. Sure, those jobs were shitty, exploitive, like forced dozens, like thousands and thousands and thousands of people into basically like horrible slavery, essentially. And then it was only by like the bitter, bitter fighting of the labor movement for decades that we finally managed to reach a sort of like detente where people had normal lives again. And now that's being already undone. The neoliberalism has undone the gains of the early 20th century in the labor movement. And we're fighting for that stuff again now, afresh in our lifetimes. Sure, maybe there are. So I read an article that was like, automation is not going to get rid of jobs. Like, sure, it's going to ruin some jobs, like trucking. It's like, don't be so coy about the trucking. The trucking's a really important one, but they just glossed over it because they don't have a good answer for it. But they were also like, there's evidence that a lot of tech sectors, you know, haven't reached the peak of their demand yet. And it's like, so we're all going to be Uber drivers?
Yeah.
Then the self-driving cars are going to fuck us. What are we all going to, like, what are we going to do? Like, that's not a life, you know? Right. Like, that, like, you don't make a shitload of money as an Uber driver. Maybe you'll have a job.
Right.
And if there's a self-driving car, you will not have a job. Mm. But, like, again, it's like, what kind of society is this? Like, sure, all these people who used to work on farms in the 19th century started working in like textile mills, but they were working like 14 hours a day and getting diseases and not making any money.
Yeah.
Like, that's not a life. That's not a society. We need better to do better than that.
Yeah. Well, and there again, like, you know, if you're in an industry that suddenly is automated by some sort of technical advancement, if you had the UBI, you could have the financial security to know that your house isn't going to disappear, but also you could then go to one of our handy dandy free universities that exist in this beautiful fantasy world and get yourself a new career path and new interest. And I think you could train with a UBI
and it wouldn't kill you.
Yeah.
You wouldn't have to work. Like, you could train and you wouldn't have to work a job.
Yeah.
Nobody would have to work a job.
Go learn a skill like it's your job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you could apply that skill. Automation also really disproportionately affect vulnerable people. Mm. The kind of people who need to fall back on a job at McDonald's or a job at grocery store cashier or, you know, driving a truck or something. Like, those people are more at risk, right? If they lose those jobs, they don't have the same resources that like a wealthy person working at like a newspaper might have. You know what I mean? Like that's part of why this is urgent as well. Like, people are about to be in crisis.
Yeah. Like, actually, even in like, this is another example in our own industry, but like, in this sort of jumping back sort of to an old point, but when I was in London, not this last time, but the time before, a teacher at one of the schools I was teaching at was talking to me and saying like, he's noticed, one of the big changes in the last like 20 years in the acting world in London is that the kids going through acting school are coming from wealthier families.
I've heard this too, yeah.
And that because it used to be a poor person's job.
Right.
You know, like you're never going to make it, kids, so you might as well be an actor.
Yeah, right.
Know? And but now the only people that can actually afford to take the risk are people from like middle income and middle upper income families.
Right.
So like, you know, yeah, if we're sending our kid to school and we can only afford to do it once, there's no way my kid is going to acting school. My kid's going to go to fucking engineering or something like that. That you know, and it's sort of the mentality and the end. But in it, yeah, actors themselves are coming from wealthier and wealthier families.
Yeah. Here's an interesting idea I read about too, is like a federal job guarantee, like a huge, massive federal government program that's like, if you don't have a job, we will get you a job.
Mm-hmm.
Like, say there was like a base level of job where it's like you sign up for a year, you make a $20,000 salary, and you'll do like, you know, infrastructure projects. Say. The government's, this is an example that I've kind of like pulled from a couple places. Like, say the government's like, we're going to create a mass program. No one's going to be unemployed. Every single person who's unemployed, we have a $20,000 contract for you with a little bit of training involved.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, we're going to upgrade everything that we can to run on renewable energy. We're going to install solar panels everywhere. We're going to create the infrastructure for solar energy, for wind energy to be linked in. Like if you join the federal jobs program, if you don't have a job, you can come join up. We need people to just like help us lay all the shit out. Right.
Yeah. Just labor.
Like, why not? Yeah. It's like, but like the federal government has to do all this stuff. Why not have a big program that can employ people? And if we had that and a UBI, suddenly we'd be cooking. You know what
right.
I mean? That's like an interesting idea too.
Mm.
Right. And a federal jobs guarantee is not expensive compared to a UBI. Like, because if you look, basically, if you're trying to employ the number of employed people we have in America, that number was like 15 million unemployed people.
Right.
If you paid 15 million unemployed people $20,000 a year, it would cost like a few billion dollars.
Right.
But which is not like a UBI to pay everyone in America $10,000 a year is going to cost $3 trillion. Of course, that's before you get the money from other places and like figure out how to pay for it.
Right.
That's like the gross figure, not the figure when you correct it for all this other stuff.
Right.
It's actually, you know, lower than that. The actual burden is a lot lower than $3 trillion. But like a federal jobs guarantee is way cheaper than a UBI because there's fewer people who are like unemployed.
Right.
But like, why can't, this is what I mean, is like, if we get a UBI, we have to start thinking of these other things
right.
too.
Like, what it's do we like, want out of it?
Yeah, and what else are we going to have? What kind of lives are we going to have? Like, I think it would be sick if there was a world where I could be like, you know what, I'm going to, if I'm getting my UBI of $10,000 a year, but I don't want to be an actor. I can sign up for the federal jobs program for like a year or 6 months or, you know, I don't know, and do a bunch of projects and make a stable amount of money and just kind of have stability for a bit and then get back on to the UBI and make art projects for possibly no money if I need to.
Yeah.
You know, like that's a world that people envision for themselves. And flipping all the way back around to Marx, that's a world where people are happier. People became happier in the Richard Nixon UBI trial because people were doing the stuff that they wanted to be doing. They could do the labor that wasn't like, you know, we say like soul crushing jobs. A soul crushing job is an alienated job. It's a job where you're not getting anything from your labor. Your labor, it's like in Marx envisions almost like a cycle. It's like you put your labor out and it comes back to you. And this
right.
is like this is humanity, right?
Right.
But in wage labor, you throw it out and it just goes away.
Right. Just disappears. And
right.
Yeah.
And you get less money than it's worth back in return.
Mm-hmm.
And fundamentally there's something draining about that. And we have all of these, you know, metaphors about how shitty work is in our society, right? Nobody likes drudgery. Nobody likes exertion and toil and stuff, but there's a difference between something when you're like, oh yeah, I know this is gonna be hard and shitty, but I'm gonna do it because I'm choosing to do it, versus like, oh, I have to work this job, it's killing me, you know, I'm like, that's unhealthy for people and it's bad for society, and that's the kind of world we can fight for, but we're at risk to not get it. That's kind of like the moral of the story today.
Right. Wow. Oh, Yeah, this is so much nicer to talk about than ISIS.
Yeah, what do you mean? What do you mean? I had an awesome time researching ISIS. I've never been happier.
It's great. It was great. I learned a lot. You know, really grabs me right in the old ideal.
I know,
idealism muscle, and just gives me a sweet little massage.
People have been fucking shitting on idealism for our whole lives, I think, but we need to get idealistic again, because the people who are fighting against us certainly understand what they want.
Yeah.
I think we need to be unafraid to have a sort of romantic notion of what society can be and to fight for that. Now, sure, we live in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe we'll never get the image in our heads, but...
No, but I always, I always like to think of it as like a big boat, right? Like our country and our world. Our country is a boat, and our world is a boat, and we're driving this boat into the uncertain future, and like, you know, people get frustrated because they can't just make the boat be where they want it to be,
mm-hmm.
but like it's not about that. It's about nudging the steering wheel, you know, mm-hmm. and like that's idealism versus realism of. The ideal is I know that where I want to go is over there.
Right.
And it's folly and naive for me to think like we can make that jump right away.
Yeah.
But the ideal is showing us where we would like to go. And so my job is to nudge the steering wheel ever so slightly as much as I can to sort of head in that ideal.
Well, as artists, our whole lives are full of stories of friends and colleagues of ours who had a crazy notion and saw it through.
Yeah.
And that notion became something magical and meaningful for many people. Something that did not seem to have inherent worth or success when you thought of it. Something that might have seemed a little nuts, a little crazy. But you know what? Like, I don't know. We've seen that that kind of thing can be done.
Yeah.
It can be done if we commit to it.
And I wonder sometimes if like, you know, all the... This I know a lot of super talented people in our field that have quit and fallen by the wayside, and it's always I think like if you make the decision to leave, it's always a good decision. You know, like if you don't want to do it anymore, you should feel happy, and nobody should A, judge you, or B, feel sorry for you, because mm-hmm. I think it's like nope, that's just the way it goes. But I wonder, I'm like, you know, there's some people who have left and I felt like, no, not you, you know,
yeah.
you're the, you know,
they have so much to offer.
You have so much to offer. I've been following your example, yep, you know,
I know.
And like, not that if we had UBI, they'd all still be here. Cause I think falling off is a natural progression in the industry, but I know people who have left because it's just too hard, you know, or like, they're like, what about kids? You know, if I have a kid,
yeah.
Like, am I, you know, and I have a month where I can't feed myself. Like, that's not responsible. I'm not going to have a kid then, you know?
And if people in our society knew how many, like, how much brilliant, wonderful, magical stuff they had missed out on because mm-hmm. that had happened.
Yeah.
Like, I bet people would want this idea even more. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
The art we could have had, the paintings you could have seen, the music you could have heard, the fucking plays you could have seen if these people had had the economic arrangements in place to be able to focus on it and not be always pulled down. Yeah. I mean, we come at it from that angle as artists, but this is true for anybody. This is true for people with families. It's true for people with, you know, startups, you know, even like I would say.
Well, as we were saying, poverty is it's a bit of a trap. You know, it is. We live in a society that is skewed in favor of those who make more money.
Yeah.
If you make more money, you are in a better spot,
mm-hmm.
Respective to how much money mm-hmm. you make. You know what I mean?
And that shit's getting out of control. Like, the amount of money that people at the top are making is getting crazier and crazier and crazier all the time. Since the 1980s, it is snowballed out of control.
Right?
Like, we need to be unafraid of the fact that we are redistributing wealth. We need to be unashamed of that fact.
Yeah.
Like, why should you have more money than you can spend in an entire lifetime?
Yeah.
While the country that allows the conditions for you to make that money, or like, is full of people who are struggling to just pay and get by. You will still have plenty. You will still have plenty.
Yeah.
You will still have more than enough.
Yeah.
But we're taking some of it. I think that's an idea we just need to not be slightly afraid to touch anymore.
Yeah. Well, you know, we have a friend called Julian Fade in Edmonton. He's a real, real smart guy, improv fellow we used to do improv with. And he used to say, you know, when you rehearse a show, when you're rehearsing a new form, a formatted show, an improv show he's talking about specifically, it's like what you're actually, you know, what you're actually improving is your worst show.
Right.
You know,
right.
Because every improv show is different. They vary in quality, you know, and the more you practice, more regularly you practice a specific format, the more regularly you perform a specific format, the better your worst show gets.
Right.
And like that should be the measure. And so like your best show, yes, your best show is getting better. But the baseline is that worst show. And I think the same of this income thing of if, maybe a maximum income maximum income wouldn't work for whatever reasons. But I just think of if as long as we keep it like you keep it moving as a unit. So like as we make more money and progress and the poor people are allowed to, you know, maybe that UBI goes up, you know, up and up and up. And eventually we can aim at that sweet, like, 70 grand a year UBI that, like, you know, whatever happiness doesn't improve after however much. Anyway, move them up together. Move the maximum income up with
it's worth saying, we'll get into this in our full communism episode, but, like, the Marxist saying about what the end of communism, the final product of communism was from each according to their ability to each according to their need. You know, like, you give what you can and you take what you need. Like,
right.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, like I feel like I'm not afraid of that idea. I think that's a nice ideal. Obviously, it can be interpreted in a lot of different ways, but sure. I think that that's a fine point to aim at. There's one other thing I want to mention before we kind of wrap up here. I think we're nearing the wrap-up point, but there's a important... The importance of the universality of the universal basic income has a lot of different points of contention, but there's one main one that I want to make. Some people say, why would you spend all this money on a program that goes to everybody if a lot of the people you're paying don't actually need it?
Right.
But an interesting argument against that is that there's a psychological thing that happens where if you need to drop off working and just rely on your UBI, you don't feel like you're going on welfare because everyone gets it.
Right.
It goes to everybody regardless as if you need it or not. It's just a fair thing that everybody gets.
Yep.
And a negative income tax, like we were talking about earlier, where like if you're not working, you get paid up to a certain point, or if you make below the poverty line, you get up to a certain point and then goes away after a while. Like that's basically just welfare. That's like if you're doing shitty, you get money, right? To make it so that you don't die or whatever, which is, you know, it's better than absolutely nothing, I suppose. But... like welfare is a, you know, there's a social stigma and humiliation that goes along with it. That is a big, and there's stigmatization about welfare and food stamps and assistance and things like this.
Absolutely.
If it goes to everybody, suddenly that psychological aspect of it isn't a part of it anymore.
I know I have a buddy in Ottawa and he's a stand-up comedian and an actor. Mm-hmm. And he was telling me about one time, he had to go on welfare. And I was like, oh, because I'd always thought welfare is when you're really in trouble, right? And it's true. He was in trouble. He was in a very similar situation to the one I found myself in, you know, about a year ago now when I was having some financial troubles. But the difference is he has a son and he has a mortgage and, you know, he can't afford to miss a beat, you know?
Yeah.
And so he goes into the welfare office and he's nervous and scared and embarrassed. And he sort of goes to the agent he's talking to and sort of expresses these feelings. And the agent, he said, was very thoughtful and lovely and patient and kind and said everybody that sits in that seat has these same embarrassments and these same feelings. And you just need to know that it's okay and that's what this is for, right? And
yeah, and like... Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Well, and like that, like effectively, I mean that's sort of it. You know, it's a there is an awful
difference between like we have this myth that it's like you should be succeeding in society if you're a good person and good at, and you're smart and good at what you do, you'll just make money, right? Like, this is myth we have about how our society works. There's all kinds of reasons a person mm-hmm. could need to go on welfare, that some of which are completely not in their control, mm-hmm. many of which have to do if they're supporting other people or not, right? Like, And it's a psychological difference between, like, I'm not doing good enough and I need help mm-hmm. versus, like, this is the wealth of our society and we all get to share it. Mm-hmm. We all get a piece of it because it only exists because we are here.
Yeah.
That's the difference. And that spiritual difference, I think it's a part of the big a piece in the puzzle that's, like, this UBI in its best form can help people have more dignified lives. It can just take that, some of that pressure out that you feel and give you options, give us the lives that rich people have been living, you know, for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years.
Yeah. And like, it's also just sort of a nice admittance, social admittance that life isn't fair. You know
exactly
what I mean? Like, one more quick tale before we wrap up, but my current downstairs neighbors are crackheads. And
wow, I mean, I live downstairs, so you didn't have to just say it.
I wanted to talk to you a long time about this.
You could say we're crackphilic,
crackophiles.
Yeah, we're crackophiles.
They have some crack issues. Well, one of them for sure does. He talked to me about it, and the other one I think has some alcohol issues. Anyway, these are two. Like, one of the fellas is literally illiterate. He can't read.
Wow.
He's 35 to 40. The other one is 40 to 45. These are poor gentlemen. And they grew up poor, and they grew up uneducated, mm-hmm. and they now have substance abuse issues and all of that. And it's interesting, when I first sort of found out who they were and what they were about, you know, I always knew that they had a bit of an edge to them, but like when I sort of found out a bit more about it, I got really nervous and scared, you mm-hmm. know, of like, oh my God, these poor criminals are living in my basement. And like, you know, there are things that are certainly like actual real world annoying, you yeah, know, like yeah. it's not a luxury to live above crackheads, but in getting to know them and like chat with them and stuff like that, I mean, it sounds so fucking obvious and didoy to say, but like to go, oh, you guys are, you know, real people. I put a label on you when I found out you were addicted to crack cocaine and, you know, no, I don't trust you to like watch my bike for a few hours. I'm not going to like say, like give you the keys to my place and say, I'm going out of town. Would you mind house sitting?
Yeah.
But, you know, to hear their stories about what they've come up against, like, you know, a single one of their stories doesn't match half of the things that have happened to me in my life, right. You know, and the difference is the grand, hideous lottery of when and where you came into existence,
right?
You know,
absolutely, and like, can you imagine how many times in the cycle of perpetuating that cycle of poverty, things could have been different if there had been a bit of a cushion for somebody, you know, like, I mean, you can never know exactly in somebody else's life, but that's the theory behind it. Anyway, we should probably wrap up. We're getting long here.
It's about time. So to wrap up, what have I learned about universal basic income? I learned
high school Jamie was a genius.
High school Jamie was pretty on his shit, guys. It's sort of a neutral issue. It's neither left or right. The idea, but the left and right have different idea end games with
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
The right being wanting it not to discourage people to work. They still want people to all to be work, and maybe it's available to them. With a caveat that they are working.
Mm-hmm.
The left seems to be pushing for the you don't have to work, so it gives you the opportunity to take time off and sort yourself out. That's the side that I team up with. Obviously, you do as well.
Go left.
Go left, baby. Yeah, and then there's all sorts of, like, one of the pitfalls is that we also need to get our labor stuff sorted out
right
at the same time as we are developing this UBI mm-hmm. system.
Yeah, it's like if you have UBI and bad jobs.
Right, because, yeah.
You're totally fucked.
And also, like, our, you know, if you just introduce this UBI, then companies could use it to pull their wages back and have the government just pay people's wages.
That's a big, big worry.
Which is what we don't want to happen.
It's super likely that could happen in Ontario, so everyone needs to be on it.
Right. Yeah. Be on your shit. Yeah,
great, man. The most important thing is, like, again, it's an easy idea. What's important is being primed on what the conversation is and what the options are, because you're going to be seeing more of this.
Right.
It's going to be in the news for everybody. Like, again, Finland's trying it. Finland's version is tied to work, which is really unfortunate and kind of a disappointment in that system. But they have their own stuff that they're figuring out and their own political situation.
Mm-hmm.
It's being trialed in Prince Edward Island and in Ontario. In Canada, it's going to be a big concept that we look at going forward. So hopefully this primer arms you with the knowledge you need to, like, when you get that CBC article sent to you by some ranting person, you understand what all these things are about.
You know,
you understand what we're getting into here.
Amazing.
Yeah.
I'm happy we finally got to do an episode that satisfies our clear socialist slant.
And also, like, nobody said a woman should be a sex slave in this episode, which was a really nice change of pace for me.
It is. It is really nice. We've hit a couple dark topics over the last little bit. We got some light ones coming up down the pipe. We will resatiate our palates. Recalibrate our palates to handle some darker hell nonsense.
That's right. We'll be back to, like, it's like sipping the, like, shitty, like, hell wine. We'll be like, yes, there's a bouquet of alt-right sexism with just a hint of Sharia law.
That's right.
Yeah.
Now we get to have a little taste of lemon sherbet, UBI socialism, so that we can...
We're going to be like horror sommeliers.
That's right.
That's like what we're becoming right now.
Slowly but surely.
Yeah. Ugh.
But hopeful. By God.
Yeah.
By God, we're hopeful.
Oh, we are. Okay, so so keep an eye out. You know, check out the fight for $15 in fairness here in Ontario or across North America. It's taking place right now. You know, stay educated, stay informed.
Yeah. As usual, comment, give us a message. If you feel engaged by this topic, if you have something to say, if you'd like to clarify something we said that you feel could be tweaked. Please engage us. Comment, message. We're on Twitter. We're on Facebook. We're on SoundCloud. And
at ExplainJamie on Twitter. ExplainItToJamie@gmail.com. ExplainItToJamie on Facebook.
That's right. Give us a rating on iTunes. That helps out. Give us five. And
give us five stars.
Yeah.
Fucking give it to us. Give us the five stars.
Give us five.
Just hit us with those sweet five stars.
Give it a like. Give it a subscribe. Share it around. Stay vigilant. Stay hopeful. Stay active. I'm Jamie.
I'm Richard.
This is Explain It to Jamie.
Yee.